today I'm here with Brian Ward-Perkins, who is at Oxford, and Brian is a specialist in the topic of the Roman Empire and the reason why it fell and the archaeology around it and all of those sorts of things. So, Brian, thanks for joining us.
That's a great pleasure. It's very nice to be with you.
Maybe could you tell us a little bit about your background and who you are and sort of how you got to where you are now?
Okay. My background is the most immediately important thing is I was born in Rome, the centre of the Roman Empire.
So you're actually a Roman?
Sorry?
You're actually a Roman then?
Yes. As I say to people in Italy, sono Romano di nascita, a Roman by birth, a true Roman. My dad was a classical archaeologist, a distinguished classical archaeologist, who wrote a very good book, which is still in print, on Roman architecture. So I was exposed to things Roman from a very early age. I may say I have three siblings. None of them went in that direction. So I was the only one who really got interested in it. And in fact, I actually got interested in a slightly later period than what my dad was interested in, namely the sort of early Middle Ages and the transition from Rome into a later period. And academically, I studied history, but I always worked partly as an archaeologist, and I've been a field archaeologist working in the field in Italy in particular, and sites in northern Italy, particularly from the late, very late Roman and very early medieval periods. So I've always been interested in things as well as texts, and in a sense I kind of combine a perspective that looks at both material evidence and at textual evidence. Unfortunately, I have a job in Oxford teaching in the history faculty, and the history faculty allows one to be very broad-minded in terms of what exactly one teaches.
Have you ever found any really interesting stuff in archaeology?
Yes, though it wouldn't necessarily count as the sort of stuff that people would queue up to see. In the very early 70s, I was involved working on a site in northern Italy called Luna. Luna was where the Carrara quarries are, and where in the Roman period they were extracting all the marble that was actually used in Rome itself. The quarries, they were called the Luna quarries, they're now called the Carrara quarries. And I was working on that site, and it was the very, very early days of people being interested in the post-Roman period. And up to the early 1970s, most Italian sites were simply cleared by pickaxe right down to the Roman levels, with no attention paid to the rather ephemeral material that stood on top of the Roman. And in the early 70s, I excavated a part of the Forum at Luna, and in fact found the remains of wooden houses which were built on top of it in the 6th century. Now, that may not sound enormously exciting, but these were actually the very first sort of post-Roman wooden houses ever identified in Italy. And that was hugely exciting at the time for those who were interested in it.
Interesting. In your book, you talk about when you were a kid that you guys dug up so much Roman pottery that you just went and threw it away in the river.
Yes. I don't think that would happen now, although it's not necessarily a completely foolish thing to do. This was actually my dad's work. I was brought up at a place called the British School at Rome, which is an academic institution with archaeologists and actually also artists there. And he ran what's called a field survey, which involved going out in the countryside, walking over ploughed fields, picking up bits of Roman pottery. And you found that where there'd been a villa or where there'd been a peasant dwelling, there was always Roman pottery. And so you could pick it up, you could chart it on a map, you could date the settlement from the types of pot used. But this produced tons and tons of pottery, and that obviously creates a storage problem. So in fact, I mean, I just remember this vividly, they used to keep the rims of the pots and the bases of the pots and any distinctive thing like the handles. And I think they kept all the smart pottery, which was most readily dateable. But the ordinary stuff was then dumped into a river. The reason it was dumped into a river is because anybody finding it later in that river would think it could have come from anywhere. It could have been washed downstream, so it wouldn't confuse the archaeological record. Whereas if you put it in a field, people might suddenly get very excited and think there was a major Roman site where they'd found it.
All right. After reading your book, I actually got very excited by the idea of Roman pottery and bought some on eBay. And I have been, I'm in the Bitcoin community, and so I've been giving it out to people in the Bitcoin community who all find it very fascinating.
Oh, good. I'm very glad. It is remarkable. I have a very nice piece of Roman pot, which I show to students, and I say, you know, guess what date this is. They never get it right because it's just too sort of modern and standardized and, frankly, just too good quality.
Mm. Well, stuff I got is from eBay, and I mean, the authenticity is unclear as well, but it's not very high quality, so it could be anything. But
if it wasn't expensive, it's probably real.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't expensive.
No, I mean, nobody's going to try and sell you. Well, at least I doubt it. I mean, maybe there's a world out there on eBay that I don't know about, but I don't think so. I mean, it is very, very common. I mean, equally, Roman coins, particularly 4th century Roman copper coins, you can buy them for, in Britain, you can buy them for, you know, under £5, which is not a lot of money for a really quite nice coin. They just produce tons and tons and tons of the stuff.
I have a Marcus Aurelius coin.
Ah, well, that's probably quite nice. If it's a big one, that might even be worth quite a lot of money.
I bought it on eBay. This one I think is real, and it was $70 or $80.
Oh, yeah. Well, that sounds about... Is it in copper or is it in silver?
I think it's silver.
Oh, that's silver. Well, that sounds like about the right price if it's in good condition. But again, that's not a huge amount of money for something so old and so beautiful.
It's astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah, and those are ordinary die cutters, of whom there must have been hundreds, possibly thousands, working across the empire, producing, because of course all of those dies are individually handmade. They're fractionally different from each other, but they're actually extremely standardized. So only by looking very, very closely at two coins could you tell they'd actually come from different dies. And they're just producing tons and tons of pottery. Of coinage.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've been to Italy, but I haven't been to Rome. I wasn't familiar at all with the Roman Empire, but just recently I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York City that has a big exhibit on the Greek and the Roman Empires, and it made it a lot more real to see everything there that we think of. I mean, as a person that hadn't been exposed to any of this, you kind of just think of that as old stuff that doesn't really have any relevance today, but these guys really had a lot of stuff together back then.
Yes, because what I argue in my book, and which in fact is, I think, indisputable, is that what's striking about the Roman world in particular, I mean, to some extent about the Greek world, but really much more about the Roman world of the first 3 centuries AD, is the scale of economic activity and the reach of economic activity. Because it's very common in the ancient world to have wonderful objects but produced at a highly elite level. So, I don't know, things like Assyrian reliefs, spectacular, or, you know, Egyptian reliefs. But those are made for, you know, the very top of society. What's so striking about the Roman world is that they're making very ordinary things, and pottery is a splendid index of that, because it really is a very ordinary type of object, and never hugely expensive. To make money out of making pottery, you have to make it in large quantities. And they're making it to a very, very high quality, to a very standardized form. And they're diffusing it widely, not just geographically. And they are diffusing it geographically. There were workshops in North Africa in the 3rd and 4th centuries, which were selling material all over the Mediterranean. Some of it even reaches Britain at that date. But they're also diffusing it socially, so that it's not just the elite that have this material, nor is it even just people in towns that have it. It actually gets right out into the countryside and onto quite low-level rural settlements where people that we would describe as peasants were actually using imported high-quality Roman pottery.
Yeah, so they got quite a system set up. One of the things that struck me from your book is that your book, it felt quite right-wing, saying, hey, capitalism, you know, has built all this stuff, and I mean, that's at least the message I got from it, and I was a little bit surprised that you were allowed to remain at Oxford after writing a book like that.
That is a fair comment, and it's a comment that I have had, and I have been attacked as very right-wing. I am actually a soggy left liberal, so I'm certainly not right-wing. I agree. It is about markets and the power of markets. But there is the sting in the tail of the book, which is about the danger of overdependence on such things. I certainly didn't write it with a political agenda. I think I wrote it because I know about the material evidence. And a lot of people writing about this period just look at the texts. And if you look at the texts, you just don't appreciate quite the nature of the Roman world. And I think, I mean, you know, even if one is left-leaning, one does have to appreciate the comfort of material objects. And I think it's desperately naive of people who are, you know, left-leaning to, as it were, deny that there is a huge benefit to be got out of having, I don't know, a fountain pen that works, a room that is centrally heated, a computer that works. I mean, there are issues about the diffusion of that material across society and the unfairnesses of the production of it, but I would really dispute that anybody doesn't actually appreciate material things, if that makes sense.
No, I mean, absolutely. I was just very surprised and impressed that tone came through. And so then as the next topic I'm curious about, you mentioned in the book that your secular views. So do I presume that you are non-religious?
Well, it's an interesting question that. I've recently been persuaded by a very nice college chaplain that the best way to look at one's religious views is in percentage terms. That there's no, as you were, absolutes a mistake. And I would have said I was probably 60% agnostic, 15% atheist, 15% traditional Church of England, and then 10% something else. So yes, essentially I'm not religious at all. And the issue I was taking issue with in the book was a view of the history of the end of the Roman Empire, which is very, very much focused on religious change.
Right.
Because there's the huge, exciting things are happening in religion in the period, but that's then ignoring all this material change. And personally, I would care more about material change than religious change.
So, I mean, you wrote the book something almost 10 years ago. How are your views now on the influence on Christianity and the decline? I mean, you obviously talk a lot about the German barbarians and all of that sort of stuff. I got the impression that Rome is, that there was a lot of influences that caused it to fall, and it didn't seem like necessarily that they had a sustainable economy. I got the impression a lot of the economy of the Romans was built around acquisition of enemy stuff, and you can only do that for a limited time after you've beaten all the enemies, and once that runs out, then you kind of run out of stuff to keep things growing. And I'm curious as to your thoughts now on the role of Christianity, and if what I'm saying there makes some sort of sense.
Okay, well, could I first just go back to what you're saying? I don't actually think the Roman economy did require constant expansion. There's absolutely no doubt at all that in its period of expansion, it did hugely well out of taking over more and more bits of the world and monstrously exploiting them. But by 300 AD, it had stopped expanding for 300 years, and it had settled down to being an essentially rather effective internal market with a single coinage, no trade barriers, a peaceful Mediterranean with no reason to interrupt trade within the Mediterranean. And in fact, actually, to go back to my own political views, I think one thing that I would hope came out of my book is actually an interest in ordinary producers and merchants and people just moving stuff around being important just as much as, you know, the elites of society are important. I mean, I think the book is partly, if it is, you know, praising production, it's praising very ordinary production rather than the elite stuff that everybody looks at, you know, the statues of this, that and the other. But I think the Roman economy was an efficient, effective machine. It was very specialized, and as I'm sure we'll come on to discuss, that makes it vulnerable, but it worked. I don't see it as actually requiring constant input of booty. It did use some input, for instance, of slaves, and one should never get rosy tinted view of what life was like in that period. I mean, it is an economy that's based, certainly for all domestic activity at an elite level, on slaves and on a huge slave trade.
I'm a big fan of Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, and was rather intrigued to learn of the various problems that slaves can cause in your day-to-day life.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, the Roman elite were unbelievably self-satisfied. They really did. I suppose they viewed slaves like we might view a washing machine. It's okay. While it works, you ignore it, and then when it doesn't work, you curse it and you blame it.
And you beat it, all those kinds of things. And Marcus Aurelius was quite proud of himself for his restraint and not beating the slaves when they would steal things or do the wrong thing.
Yes, yes. Well, there's a terrible, terrible story which actually I tell in my book, which is about a late 4th century Roman aristocrat who's going to hold games in honour of one of his sons, holding one of the offices of state. And when you held an office of state, you held games to entertain the people, to mark this person taking up office. And he's going to hold games, and he's very proud of himself because he actually gets hold of 29 Saxon prisoners of war. These are people from right North Germany. And he's got them down to Rome, and he's really looking forward to holding the games. The games are going to consist of these people killing each other as gladiators. And they kill themselves in prison rather than appear in public as gladiators, which must have been horrendous. They basically strangle each other. It's a very heroic, we would see it as a heroic act of defiance by people who are free and didn't want to be humiliated. This aristocrat writes a letter about it. He describes what happens. And he says, that these slaves have basically insulted him by killing themselves. I mean, he sees it entirely from his own point of view, as if, these people were wicked people who had deprived him of the right of seeing them kill each other in honour of his son's games. No, so, I mean, it's not a good world.
Where did they get their slaves from?
They were Saxons. Saxons, of course, are the people who invade Britain in the 5th century, but they're coming from the north, from North Germany on the coast, quite a long way away.
Were these white slaves or black slaves?
Oh, these are white.
So all the Roman slaves, white slaves? I think there were a lot of them were black, were they not?
They had black slaves as well, but the majority would be from the north of the Danube and east of the Rhine. They'd be Germanic peoples, fair-haired, white-skinned people.
Yeah, interesting.
My ancestors.
Probably both of us. So one of the things that has been fascinating to me is that in we know in academia there's I mean, and you'll be probably more familiar with this than I am, but there's a number of topics which aren't really supposed to be researched, and this is I was a little bit surprised by some of the tone of the right wing that came out of your book, at least to me, as being more right wing than I'm used to seeing from academia. And essentially in some areas, and particularly around gender and race, we've decided as a society that we aren't going to research these topics based on reason. We're going to leave them as they are. One of the things that surprised me is I've actually gotten quite interested in Stoicism. And so if you ask me what is my religion, I would say my religion, you know, as far as a religion could be, is Stoicism. And I'm sort of studying that more in depth at the moment. One of the things that's interesting to me is that in Stoicism they talk about the logos or nature, which is the concept of the world being based on reason. And it was a really interesting thing that I came across is when you look at the logos, it's actually what happened as Christianity came along is that they defined the logos as the word of God. So prior to Christianity, logos was based on reason. You know, this was the final word, was based on reason. And then when Christianity came along, it was based on the word of God. Now, we haven't, our level of reason today is a lot more advanced than it was 2,000 years ago. But we still have areas in academia which are not based on reason. And, you know, for obvious reasons. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
I think you're going to have to be a bit more precise about giving me an example of academic myopia. I'm not sure I fully understand the question.
I mean, I could give you a very uncomfortable topic, and that's race and IQ. That's a topic that we're not allowed to discuss. And I mean, you know, it's an unpleasant topic, but that's a topic that is essentially banned. And I'm just curious to notice that this same dynamic of moving away from reason happened as Christianity came in. Just when you take the final word of everything goes from reason over to the word of God, you can then define things as God says. I don't know. Maybe I'm not making sense.
No. I do see what you're saying. I suppose I would have said that it's probably the case that all societies in all periods, you know, have their unthought, often unsuspected boundaries, and also, of course, their unthought, totally unsuspected prejudices, which they can't really detect themselves. I mean, if one just thinks back to our own society, you know, just 100 years ago, we'd probably believe that women were deeply inferior. This is me talking to you, two men talking together. We'd think that they weren't really competent to have the vote. We might be thinking they're competent to have the vote. And we'd assume that the British class structure, which is still pretty powerful, but was then, you know, completely and totally dominant, was absolutely right. We'd also assume that the British, you know, had a God-given right to rule other inferior peoples. So I don't know that I think the truth is that everybody has strange views, which in time are revealed to be particularly strange. I do agree. I mean, there is an interesting contrast between the Greco-Roman world and the immediately post-Greco-Roman world, with the rise of what we would think of as fundamentalist religious belief, and which to many of us is much less attractive than the Greco-Roman world. Though I suppose we do have to realise that that's our perspective. We happen to chime better with what the Greco-Roman world was interested in.
Interesting. Have you looked at...
I myself find many of the early Christian writers who, at their worst, are profoundly, fundamentalist and deeply prejudiced against, other religions. Very, very unattractive. But I also have to appreciate they were intelligent people who thought that way.
Yeah.
And I'm probably thinking all sorts of things that in 100 years' time will seem to be very, very strange. I've no idea what they'll be. I mean, it's possible in 100 years' time people will have decided that eating animals is really the most monstrous thing that could ever be done. It's perfectly possible. Or in 100 years' time, people could have gone back to deciding that women are deeply inferior and can't possibly have the vote. I mean, either of these things are possible.
Yeah, no, I mean, things change. And you know that more than most with your work.
Yes.
Have you, in your work, looked much at Stoicism, and have you run across much of the views of that? I guess maybe that's a little bit before your period.
That's a bit before my period, and to be honest, that's at the sort of high intellectual level of philosophy, which is, to be honest, a bit beyond me. I'm not very good at that kind of stuff.
Somehow I doubt that, but I'll take your word for it.
Okay.
Since the book has been published, have your thoughts or views on what you wrote changed?
Not enormously, no. I'm somebody who likes to just move on. So I've actually subsequently engaged in a very academic project, which was looking at statues in the late Roman world and how they were used, and producing an online searchable database of them. So I've decided, I wrote that, very happy with it, and I've kind of left it where it is. It's been pretty wide. I mean, there are some people who don't like it, but in general, it's hard to dispute, I think, the overall economic message, which is of dramatic change at the end of the Roman world, and I'm still pretty happy with it. I mean, I think the thing that I'd like to emphasize is it is one way of looking at the end of the Roman world, which is from the material perspective, which I personally think is extremely important. But it is also true that you can look at the period as a period of dynamic, very, very interesting change, particularly religious change. Key, obviously, is the rise of Christianity in 312. The Emperor Constantine happens to be a Christian. By good luck, or perhaps willed by God, he conquers the whole Roman world, sets up a Christian dynasty. The Roman Empire becomes Christian, which is a massively important change. I mean, the whole future intellectual shape of the Western world is determined by that change. So there's no denying it is important, and you can see it as a positive thing if you want. I mean, it's possible to see it as a negative thing, but it's obviously big and really important. And then, 7th century, out of Arabia, where nobody expected anything ever to come, suddenly emerges a new religion and an army, which conquers the whole Persian Empire, half the East Roman Empire, and sets up Islam. So it's a period with huge, dynamic, vastly interesting changes. And I was wanting to focus on a different story, which is slightly less fashionable at the moment, which is the story of what I define as the end of a civilization, but in very material terms.
Right. I guess I would just want to come back to this this thing of the logos. It feels to me that this concept of moving away from reason to faith. One of the things that, I mean, Stoicism is a philosophy built on reason. It came from the Cynics. They were, you know, mildly crazy, and but you know, everything, they were very fiercely logical. And we also know that the Romans, I think they weren't always terribly nice people. And certainly didn't treat the you know, shall we say, the unwashed masses particularly well. That I get the feeling that Christianity was sort of a way to take control. And when you move away from reason to faith, that becomes a way of disempowering the Romans that are running everything. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I mean, obviously, in theory, a switch to Christian values would be a switch away from an elite, because, in a sense, everybody can have faith, and you don't need to be philosophically trained to have it. And also, in theory, at least, Christianity favours the downtrodden.
Right.
The Sermon on the Mount is very clear on that subject. In practice, it didn't really quite work out that way, unfortunately, because the downtrodden did do a bit better after Christianity because they became the recipients of charity. But it was always charity which the elite was using in order to display its wealth and also to get to heaven. In a sense, you know, the charity wasn't really focused on the poor. It was focused on the elite's ability to give away money in order to get to heaven. And equally, I mean, you know, the most striking thing is Christianity, unfortunately, certainly didn't mean people stopped killing each other. I mean, turning the other cheek and loving thine enemy never really functioned. It wasn't a terribly effective state mechanism for...
No, and they were able to come up with new ways of killing each other, I'm sure.
Yes. And also then, because in fact what they did is they looked back to the example of the Old Testament, where of course the God of Israel positively encourages you to slaughter your enemies in the name of God. And arguably that was a dreadful discovery that you could actually kill people as a religious activity.
One thing, but I read, I don't remember if it was in your book or in another, said that as Christianity came in and the Roman Empire fell, that the nutritional levels of the everyday Romans increased dramatically, that they were eating a lot better, and you know, it sounds like life got a lot better for them.
I don't believe that at all. I think that I don't see how they could possibly have a connection between a religious change and a nutritional change.
Not necessarily tying that to the religion, just in general, as the Roman Empire fell, that the quality of life went, the nutrition went up for the average person. Is that not accurate?
I don't know. The only way you could prove that would be by doing very detailed work on skeletons.
Right, I think it came out of dental records.
Sorry?
I think it came out of dentals when they were looking at people's teeth.
Yes, you could possibly do it that way. I don't think that work's been done, but also there's a major problem there because it's possible, I mean, it is possible that in the late Roman world, say of the world of around 300, there were many millions of people, and then in the post-Roman world, there were far fewer numbers of people, but possibly those fewer number of people were individually better fed. That is possible. But the overall economy had shrunk, so that in a sense it's only sustaining a few people who are better fed. I don't think I believe that.
Right. Have you been to, I'm forgetting the name, the town that was buried, Vesuvius?
Pompeii.
Have you been to Pompeii?
Oh, yes, several times.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it's like? I mean, particularly from your perspective.
Oh, it's extraordinary. I mean, the wonderful thing about Pompeii is you walk down the street of Pompeii and it doesn't feel that desperately alien. I mean, that's a slightly false feeling because, you know, the houses look like houses and you could imagine living in them, and the stuff they have, you know, you could imagine using. I mean, it is a false perspective because actually if you were in Pompeii, you know, you would come across a class structure, a slave society, a series of religious beliefs, which would be completely and totally alien. But the actual physical appearance of the town, which is what you strikes you when you go there, is very, very remarkable and well worth seeing. I mean, just to get that sort of sense of, this is a long time ago, when, you know, we're nearly 2,000 years ago, and there are people living in a way that we find readily recognisable.
The more things change, the more things stay the same.
Yes. But what I was interested in my book is that, you know, is arguing that then in 300, between 300 and 500, there's a dramatic collapse. There's nothing like Pompeii. You can't find a city like Pompeii for 1,000 years or so. I mean, I don't think the economy recovers after the end of the Roman world until around, I don't know, 1,000, 1,100, 1,200, a centuries long, very, very deep recession.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, because the Romans had a lot of technology which got lost, didn't it?
I mean, yes.
Like they'd started inventing the steam engine.
No, they did have water power, which were they're using it, for instance, for sawing up marble, and they're using it for grinding grain. It's not completely lost. What happens at the end of the Roman world is it just becomes extraordinarily rare. I suppose the obvious technologies that do disappear are things like aqueduct engineering or building huge buildings of vast concrete domes. I mean, things like the Pantheon in Rome, which is a remarkable building. And no one could build anything like that till, oh, I don't know, one's probably talking about the 15th, 16th century.
Hmm. And they were also, I mean, and this is actually tying into your research on statues, they were pretty angry about the Roman statues, weren't they? Like there's one statue of Marcus Aurelius that still stands, but that's the only Roman statue that's left still standing. The others all got torn down and reused.
Yes, for the most part, they just lost interest in them. I mean, obviously, the Christian world didn't like pagan statues. Those were torn down and sometimes violently destroyed. But actually, for the most part, they just lost interest. Which is fascinating, and it's really only very many centuries later that people got interested in them and started appreciating them again. I mean, it's strange to us. I mean, we look at these things and we think, you know, they're obviously valuable, they're obviously worth keeping. But in fact, people looked at the great bronze statues and they thought bronze, and they melted them down. And, you know, use the bronze. It's a sort of more pragmatic approach.
Another thing that did get destroyed was, I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of Stoicism because it's helped me a lot personally, is a lot of Stoicism materials got destroyed. A friend told me, and so I don't have a source for this, but he said that the reason we have as much material left from Stoicism today that we do is because the Arabs kept it.
Oh, that's certainly true. And incidentally, I was just thinking about what you were saying about, you know, the contrast between the world of the philosophers and the world of the Christians. I mean, I think you're right. There is a big shift. It's an interesting shift, though, because the world of the philosophers is a world of a very, very small elite,
right,
who have studied this stuff, can read Greek, have, you know, thought deeply, and actually have leisure. None of these people work. They're all, as it were, you know, sitting there thinking and feeling and feeling good. But it does require, it only works at the very, very, very top levels of society. In no way does that permeate any further down. And so if you wanted to look positively at the impact of Christianity, I mean, Christianity was a religion that involved a much wider section of society. And in fact, elite paganism as well was an essentially elite religion. There were popular forms of it, people going to rural shrines and things like that, but an awful lot of it was about very grand people doing very grand sacrifices in the presence of a large audience. It wasn't really much involvement from a wider group.
You're talking about the philosophy?
Well, particularly the philosophy, but even, you know, just the sort of traditional civic paganism that you do in a town. I mean, it was very much about sort of reinforcing the position of the elite within the town. And Christianity did not, it was not a revolutionary, it potentially is a revolutionary religion, because obviously it's about some rather strange people wandering around the Sea of Galilee doing things like, you know, turning the other cheek and saying, you know, love your enemy and blessed are the peacemakers, etc. But it certainly wasn't like that. But it was a religion, for instance, that involved people, so that there's a huge difference in pagan temples where you've always got a very small space where the statue of the god was and which only a few people ever got access to, and Christian churches, which were always designed to bring vast numbers of people into them. Now, one might or might not find that attractive, because in a way, it's about a shift to a more demotic, fundamentalist, stir-up-the-crowds type religion,
right,
which I don't necessarily find terribly attractive. But one does have to accept that it did in fact involve more people. Whereas your Stoic position is a very elite one. I mean, I applaud it. Great. Go for it.
Well, I mean, just one thing to note is that Epictetus was a slave, and he's one of he was one of the foremost philosophers in Stoicism. So they weren't totally closed to everybody, but I think it's fairly difficult stuff that made it pretty inaccessible to most people. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that Paul the Apostle was, if he wasn't involved in Stoicism, was certainly around it a lot, and it seems that he included a lot of Stoicism in Christianity.
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, there obviously is a powerful influence. I mean, Christianity wasn't immune. I mean, the people, the early Christians were, and certainly the Christians of the 3rd, 4th century were highly educated people who'd imbued Greco-Roman culture and therefore, as it were, inevitably took into their new Christian culture a lot of what they'd taken from the pre-Christian past. And they certainly, I mean, nobody stopped reading the pre-Christian material. They might be hesitant about the religious message of it, but they went on reading it.
Right. I mean, I'll tell you what happened to me. I was depressed, and I realized I was depressed. I grew up Roman Catholic, but I have been agnostic since then, since, you know, about 12. Yeah. And I'd been looking, because I'd been hearing about Stoicism, and I'd been looking at it a little bit more, and I'd gotten interested in all this. And so one day I just decided to read Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. And that night, it made a huge, it was a really profound impact. And I now, when people talk about religious revelations or being a born-again Christian or all of that kind of stuff, I get that very profoundly, because that happened to me thanks to Marcus Aurelius and the book Meditations. One of the key ingredients for depression is what's called rumination, where you cycle over and over on unproductive thoughts. And Marcus Aurelius essentially just showed me how to stop that. And the feeling was absolutely transformational. And I didn't realize that I'd had this before, but I had a lot of anxiety and it went away.
Gosh, well, I may say I feel deeply honoured to be in the electronic company of a born-again stoic.
That's right. So, hallelujah.
So I think it's probably a first for me. I may have been in the company of others, but they haven't admitted it. And I absolutely promise you solemnly, Adrian, I shall go and reread the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. And I don't know whether you're getting anything out of this interview, but I've certainly got something very valuable out of it. Thank you.
I carry this coin of Marcus Aurelius around in my wallet now, because it was just, I don't know, it was just, I didn't expect it. It came out of nowhere. I've told a bunch of people to read it, and generally they think I'm a bit strange, but a couple have also found it pretty impactful.
Yes, I mean, sorry, to go back to the contrast, you know, at the end of the Roman world, I mean, it is the case, it's undeniable that up until the 4th, 5th century, people wrote things that are self-reflexive. And not actually Christians as well, because Augustine's Confessions is a remarkable book. I don't know whether you've ever read it.
I haven't.
It's a very, very readable account of his own conversion and his move towards Christianity. And it's a intelligent, interesting, self-analytical work. And then, in fact, they stopped doing this for about 1,000 years. And it is the case that we immediately identify much more readily with the literature of the Greco-Roman world and the thinking of the Greco-Roman world, largely because it's got people who are actually thinking about where they are in the world and where they stand, and that just does stop at the end of the Roman world. So the point I think you were sort of working around about the impact of Christianity is probably correct, although I think it may also be tied actually to economic change, because some of the early Christian writers, like Augustine, are deeply self-reflexive. And I think actually, you know, it is possible that the world just got culturally a little bit simpler because part of the infrastructure that supported the degree of leisure that people had, you know, to indulge their own, you know, self-reflection goes. I don't know, that's a difficult question.
So moving on to 2013, are we going to fall like the Roman Empire did?
I very, very, very much hope not. I don't... My book ends with a moral, which is to tell the modern world that there is a danger of terrible collapse. And what I argue in my book is that precisely because the Roman world was so sophisticated and so complex, that it consisted of lots of people in distant, complex relationships, economic relationships, which created the prosperity, the widespread prosperity of the Roman world. But precisely because it was so sophisticated, when it collapsed, the collapse was so total, because instead of having people who knew how to make pottery locally, they were buying it from hundreds of kilometers away. So when those markets collapsed, they didn't know how to do it anymore. They weren't able to recreate local markets. And obviously that, for what happened at the end of the Roman world, is as nothing to what would happen to our world were our economic complexity to collapse. I don't predict how that might happen, and I don't actually think it is imminent, and I don't see an immediate threat to our well-being. But all I say in my book is that, you know, don't let's assume that everything is going to go on getting better and better, more and more complex, more and more prosperous. And of course, 2008 I mean, did reveal some of the dangers. I mean, fortunately, 2008, in comparison to the end of the Roman world, is a mere, you know, tiny little economic blip. But it did sort of reveal how the extreme complexity that we got ourselves into has its dangers, as well as its benefits. I think everybody would now accept that, but that's largely because of that experience in 2008. So, no, I don't necessarily think we are headed for disaster, but what I do think is that we walk along a tightrope of complex prosperity, which we need to look after carefully.
I think that's a very good way to say it. Is there anything else that you'd like to add in closing? Or anything that we haven't discussed?
No, I don't think so. I accept that I've much enjoyed talking to you. You've made me think. Very, very difficult, the questions you ask around things like, you know, the relationship between ancient philosophy and religious change. I probably dodged your questions on politically correct subjects. It's hard, but no, I don't think so. I'm very happy with the conversation. I've enjoyed it.
I guess you didn't expect to get hit with all of this from an internet geek, but I appreciate you taking the time to answer my questions.
Oh, no, it's fun talking about things. No, I've hugely enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for doing the interview.
That's a great pleasure.